All right, so I hope I at least semi-convinced you that K.Rac fermions have some connection to staggered fermions, and that they can be discretized in a way which preserves a great deal of the structure of the continuum K.Rac theory. And that structure can be equivalent to the structure of a Dirac theory in flat space, but it's certainly not in curved space the same. The coupling of integer spin fields to gravity is not the same as the coupling of spinners. And in fact, you see in very broad terms that there are massless modes of the Kähler-Dirac equation on spheres, which are not there for Dirac fermions. So global structures are different. So I'm now going to turn to this anomaly I've been advertising for a while. And you can do this calculation sort of following Fujikawa in the continuum. You can introduce a spin connection and a frame and follow Fujikawa's sort of derivation of the U1, the ABJ anomaly with a path integral. But it's actually much, much easier to use the lattice construction we talked about. And you'll see that it's almost trivial. So I'll just remind you again, we had some, I won't even write it down. There is some Kähler-Dirac action, which involves phi and phi bar. I'll just say phi. And I argued last time that if I set the mass to zero, there's an exact symmetry of that action corresponding to taking these fields phi and rotating them according to gamma with the same rotation for phi bar, right? Because gamma anti-commutes with the Kähler-Dirac operator, this is the symmetry. It's like a chiral symmetry of the Kähler-Dirac action, right? So you have this classical symmetry. And you know that classical symmetries can be violated by anomalies. And one way to see that classically, so to speak, is to look at the path integral measure, right? So in this case, you know, my partition function involves integrating over phi and phi bar, you know, e to the minus some Kähler-Dirac action, right? I said this at an invariance, but I have to look at the transformation of this measure under this symmetry. And I'm going to do it on the lattice because this symmetry survives on the lattice. Gamma still anti-commutes the discrete Kähler-Dirac operator. So all of this symmetry is exactly the same. So I'm going to do this all on the lattice. So I just have to figure out when I do this rotation on all, remember this measure here is a product of all the P simplices, D phi P bar, D phi P. So I have a P simplex, or if you're P field, P form field living on every P simplex in the lattice. This is a very well defined, for a finite volume, a very well defined multiple integral. I can simply do the transformation on the measure and see what I get, right? Hopefully I get one. If I don't get one, I have an anomaly, or rather, the transformation being one. So let's just do that, right? So what do I get? I get, when I look at the zero forms, right, that tells me, let's look at the product of all zero forms, right, d phi I. Well, they all pick up e to the I alpha because the zero form has gamma equals plus one, right? So I get e to the plus I alpha. They all pick up the same phase. So the total, when I product over all the forms, I just pick up the number of points, right? So I get a factor of e to the I alpha for every point. And now you see what's going to happen. When I do this for the one forms, and of course, there's actually twice that because I have a d phi bar to do too. So it's two alpha n zero that goes up here. Is that clear? There's a d phi and e phi bar, right? So I get two integration, there's a d phi bar to do as well, right? So I get a factor of e to the two I alpha for each point on the lattice. I have n zero points, that's the total phase. So I have something similar for the one forms, right? And now it's e to the minus 2i alpha n1, because these have gamma equals minus 1. And so I get a minus sign here, and this is the total number of links in the lattice. And so you see what's going to happen. The total measure, d phi bar, is going to, in general, transform by the following factor, e to the 2i alpha n0, e to the minus 2i alpha n1, e to the 2i alpha n2, et cetera, et cetera. So it's e to the 2i alpha n0 minus n1 plus n2 minus n3 in any number of dimensions. And this is the Euler characteristic chi. So the measure is not invariant under that simple U1 transformation. Right? So this is an example of a quantum mechanical system, something with a finite number of degrees of freedom, which has an anomaly. The measure is not invariant under a classical U1 symmetry. All right, so I can shrink. So I suppose I'm thinking in two dimensions, and I take the simplest triangulation of the two-sphere, which is a tetrahedron, four points. I get the same answer. So it's completely independent of the lattice spacing. There are no lattice artifacts in this, of course. It's just the topological number. All right? Yeah?
Can one understand all anomalies using parking tickets? Is there a general statement?
I think that's above my pay grade, but as far as I know, you can always couch the arguments in terms of path integrals, but there may be exceptions that I'm not aware of. But there are very few examples where the anomaly survives exact on the lattice, independent of the number of points, essentially, as long as you make the topology consistent. So you need a minimum of 4 points, because that's what you need to make chi equals 2, right, in two dimensions, for example. All right, so that's cute. So one thing I can do is I can just, start considering manifolds with different topology and see what the phase would look like. So this is a phase transformation of the partition function. So it goes like e to the 2i.
This is for just the phi plus?
No, I'm done both. That's the 2. Right, so there's a d phi and a d phi bar. And the reason I put 2 in here, so there should really be. So it's the full Kähler Dirac field, not a reduced field. So the 2 here is because both of these transform the same way. So I get 2 contributions per link or per site or per triangle or whatever. So I get e to the I alpha or e to the minus I alpha, depending on even or odd, and a factor of 2 because phi and phi bar, and then I'm just counting the total number in the triangulation. Yeah.
Anomalies, you have a symmetry, and then when you gauge it, you see the anomaly. So,
that's a good question. You can think of this as a kind of Toft anomaly, because if I was doing it in the continuum, I'd have to have something like a spin connection in the game. Right? So the diagram, so for example, in four dimensions, would have this U1 current coming in, and then gravitons coming out. It'd be a one-loop diagram if I was to do this in the continuum. Just like the conventional one. It's not the same answer as the conventional one because it's not viral fermions, but it's a similar diagram. But, switch gauging it is going from flat space to curved space, switching on the spin connection. So you can sort of think of it as a Toft anomaly if you want. Just like you can think of the ABJ anomaly as a sort of Toft anomaly, right? It's a mixed anomaly between a U1 current and a gauged U1 symmetry, right? Even the usual ABJ is like that.
Familiar with is that when you do the calculation of the Jacobian.
Yeah.
The Jacobian typically depends on the background gauge and all that. So here, it seems to just depend on your space.
I'm sort of in some sense fixing the gauge, right? Because I'm using some sort of abstract triangulation where all my links are length one, say, and I'm parameterizing a curved space by that abstract triangulation. So it's sort of gauge fixed. It's a physical manifold at that point that's just approximated by, say, triangles.
So maybe the way to think about it is that you start with flat space where you know there's going to be
right
sort of zero.
So I have this exact symmetry in flat space.
And then you change the lattice.
Right, and I have a flat spin connection if I want to do it in the continuum. And then I switch, I imagine gauging or putting a non-trivial background on, right? And then I get this anomaly. And so in that sense, you can think of it as a Toft anomaly if you want. But it's also very analogous to the ABJ anomaly, right?
But Simon, this doesn't it say that there is no anomaly if the manifold has zero Euler characteristics?
Right, which is why you've never seen this before on the torus.
But I know that the ABJ anomaly is there on the torus.
But this isn't the ABJ anomaly.
I know, so that's what's confusing.
So this is a new gravitational anomaly that's specific to Kaler-Dirac fields. It's not even the usual gravitational anomaly for Weyl fermions. Right. It's a new one, a different one.
Okay.
It's not new, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. Well, I was listening to the introduction. I thought it was a global anomaly, but since here you are mentioning that it is a Tahoof anomaly, can I like cancel this Tahoof anomaly by putting it on the boundary of some higher dimensional bulk?
Let's see. The answer to that is I'm not. Let's see.
I don't know.
I tell you one thing I have done recently is to look at the reduced Kaler-Dirac. So I'm about to say this, but so let me say it now. This is a global symmetry which is, you know, gives an anomaly, but it's not harmful by itself for the full Kaler-Dirac field. But if I was to try to gauge the U1 symmetry here, the gamma symmetry, right, that would then be an inconsistent theory, right? Because of the presence of this global anomaly, right? This prevents me, if I do the same calculation where I've, if you want, gauged the U1, right? So this was a global U1 initially, but I could imagine gauging it in principle, certainly in the continuum. And if I tried to do that, the presence of this anomaly would lead to an inconsistent gauging, right? The theory would be inconsistent. But of course, that's equivalent to coupling the theory to a reduced Kaler-Dirac theory, because the reduced theory brings in a gamma projection. So what you can say is, when you look at this, is that the reduced Kaler-Dirac theories cannot be coupled to gravity consistently. This is just analogous to what one would say about Dirac fermions. You know, the presence of the ABJ anomaly by itself is not harmful, but it does imply that if you try to gauge it, you will have an inconsistency, and that means that you cannot write down a theory of Weyl fermions coupled to U1. So the same thing is true here. These reduced fermions, reduced Kaler-Dirac fermions, can't be consistently coupled to gravity. Definitely, they're inconsistent. However, you can try to put them on the boundary of another space and hope anomaly inflow fixes things for you. So that's actually something we have worked on recently, and the answer is yes. So in the case of the reduced fermion, you can certainly realize it on the boundary of a bulk space of one higher dimension, at least in the continuum. I'm not sure about the lattice, actually, but in the continuum, at least. But the actual full Kaler-Dirac field, I'm less certain of, actually. I don't know. I've not even thought about it, really. The natural thing to look for is the analog of Weyl fermions, which are these reduced fermions. And they certainly can be realized as boundary fields, like in a topological insulator type setup, with a Chern-Simons term and anomaly inflow from that Chern-Simons term, fixing things, yeah. So I can't, all right, so that's that. I can't couple these things in general to gravity. The other point I'd make, actually, which we'll need later on, is the fact that if I'm thinking of myself in infinite space, R to the n, I can always compactify that to a sphere by adding one point, right? So there's a very natural compactification of flat space, which basically just involves replacing, you know, r to the n by s to the n, right? And if the radius of the sphere is large enough, that you would thought would make no real difference. But s to the n has chi equals 2, right? So if I look at this anomalous phase here, it will then go like e to the 4i alpha. So this would break the original u1 down to a z4. Right, so in any even dimension, the U1 breaks to Z4. Right, if I pick some other topology, this would still be consistent, right? Because it's all multiples. This is like the minimum if you want for a compact manifold. So this Z4 is generic in even dimensions. In odd dimensions, there's no anomaly because chi vanishes. Right. So again, it's a little analogous to chiral symmetry. There aren't any of these anomalies in odd dimensions, but there are in even dimensions. That's how you can make the anomaly inflow thing work in one higher dimension, by starting from anomaly-free theory. There has to be anomaly inflow to fix the problem on the boundary. because you know the whole theory is anomaly free.
So you should always put it on the tortoise. Don't put it on
anything. So I'm not really advocating, unless you have some condensed matter system which lives on the surface of a sphere, which I guess that maybe, you know, I don't know. Fullerenes or something, I don't know. Suppose there are situations where you want to put fermions on the surface of something with non-trivial topology, then I think this is the right strategy to use, if you care about that. If you don't care about that, then you live on the torus. But nevertheless, what I'm going to argue is there are constraints that you can derive when you're off the torus, which still remain valid when you take the flat space limit, which because they're related to the anomaly or anomaly structure.
Sorry, another question. Just in two dimensions, I thought chi can be as negative as possible because genus can be.
Yeah, well, the sign doesn't matter, right? So as long as I can, the Z-core symmetry will hold on any arbitrarily negative chi, because it's just multiples of the same rotation. If I make it work on chi equals 2, it will certainly work on chi equals minus 2, minus 4, minus 6, right? Because they're just multiples of the coefficient for chi equals 2. Yeah, so there's something, you know, the Z4 is kind of picked out, especially, at least in even dimensions.
Minimum.
Yeah, it's the minimum. I mean, if you say, yeah, right, I think it's, I mean, if you start working on manifolds with boundary in different Euler, then you have to think again. So there are other constraints that might come in if you're on a particular manifold, say with a boundary where chi is 1 or a disk or something like that. That would be different. But if you just stick to compact manifolds.
I think you said it, but let me just make sure. You said this anomaly exists only in even space time domain?
Yes.
But not in odd?
No, because chi is 0 generically, right?
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
But you also don't have a gamma.
Oh, I have a gamma, actually. I have a gamma in even in odd dimensions. It just counts the oddness of the form. So the gamma survives, but not the anomaly.
But then what's the meaning of plus and minus in odd dimensions?
Counts the oddness, that, you know, same as it is in even dimensions. It's the same story. If the form is even or odd.
No, but,
So it's actually a little different from gamma phi. There is a gamma in odd dimensions. It just has no anomaly. Yeah. And by the way, let me stress again, there are no regular gamma chiral anomalies here. These are vector-like theories. Even the reduced theory is vector-like. The only anomalies are gravitational, and they involve this new gamma, which is specific to Kähler Dirac fields. It's twisted chiral symmetry. All right. What was I going to say? Okay, so how much time do I have? When did I start? I don't remember.
You have 20.
15, 20 minutes. Okay. Okay, so let me go on then. I don't think there's anything more I need to say about this. So, as I said before, you can actually do this calculation in the continuum. It's considerably more tricky, but standard. And you get the same answer, so it certainly doesn't depend on the... And it's another verification the lattice is not important here. It's able to see the same structure. But if you go to the continuum, there's another mixed anomaly, Toft anomaly, that arises, I think, which is... which places further kind of constraints on the infrared behavior. So I'll go to this matrix basis. I'm not going to sketch it in great detail, but suppose. So I'll introduce, in this case, a spin connection, et cetera, and a frame, at least notionally, just to show you what happens. So here's my Kähler Dirac action on some curved space in the continuum. So E is the frame, and d mu on psi here. It's the ordinary derivative of psi, usual thing, plus the commutator of the spin connection with the psi. So why is it the commutator? Precisely because psi transforms this way. Right? It looks a little bit like an adjoint field, if you want. So what you see is that it... So if I was doing Dirac fermions, it would just be omega on psi, the spinner. because I have this matrix structure, what ends up is you get a commutator of this, right? So just to fill it in, E A mu, I'm in the Euclidean space, so I don't care about my indices so much, but the metric's just essentially the square of the frame. All right, and in this language, by the way, for example, again, let's go to two dimensions because that's the easy case. The Euler number can be written as one over 4 pi integral r mu nu a b, putting all the indices in, epsilon mu nu epsilon a b, where this r is the usual curvature of the spin connection. It's the usual Yang-Mills curvature associated with omega, the spin connection. So if I do this anomaly calculation of the continuum, that's kind of what I end up with. All right. Let's see how to. So when I write it in the continuum, though, you can see there's actually another kind of interesting symmetry that appears, which is sort of visible when you look at this transformation. There's another global Z2 here. Corresponding to taking basically L to be 1 or minus 1, minus the unit matrix, like the center. Right? Because there are two of them, and they commute, they're just proportional to the unit matrix, the size of singlet under this Z2. So the matter field doesn't transform under the Z2. Right? It's like adjoint fermions in QCD. Right? So there's an additional global Z2 symmetry, which is apparent in the continuum, corresponding to this. So if you want, it means that L goes like e to the I alpha sigma 3 in two. Let's just do two dimensions again. So I can take, if I take L, take alpha to be zero or pi, then I get those two elements, right? So there's a piece of this which doesn't act on the fermions, but only acts on the spin connection, or at least it implements basically large gauge transformations on the spin connection of this form, right? So this, in fact, it acts on Wilson lines, right? So a Wilson line is, you know, e to the integral, in this case, omega dx, around some non-trivial. So now I want to be on the torus, actually. So I want to be on, I want a non-contractible loop. Right? And what happens is it takes w into minus w, you know, e to the I pi times w. So there's a global Z2 symmetry, which is like a center symmetry, which acts just on the spin connection, if you want. And it's specific to Kähler Wright because it's only then that this is invariant. And if I had Dirac fermions, this wouldn't be there because I'd only have one factor of L, basically. Because I have two, there's this additional symmetry. It doesn't act on the matter fields, it doesn't act on local observables, it only acts on Wilson lines. It's what's in modern parlance is called a one-form symmetry. There's been a lot of work in the last decade or so, maybe not quite a decade yet, on generalized symmetries. The symmetries we've discussed so far are all called zero-form symmetries. They act on fields located at points. This acts on an extended object, the Wilson line. And so both the Z4 we talked about and the Z2 are perfectly good global symmetries of the theory. And in fact, there's no anomaly with the Z2. They're perfectly good global symmetries. So the Z4 and this Z2, I'll put C on it for center, are good symmetries of the quantum theory. I haven't figured out how to do this on the lattice, and that's what I've been struggling with this week to see if I could, before this talk, figure this out, but I couldn't. So I can only give you the continuum argument. And you know in the end it will place constraints on the continuum theory, so those should be relevant for the lattice theory too, but it will be, you feel it should be possible to make this argument on the lattice, I just haven't figured it out. Because I don't have the omega in the way I was talking about curved space, so I have to think of a different way of doing it. So I have these two good symmetries, and I can imagine, if I'm thinking about Toft anomalies, trying to gauge one or both of them, right? And so I just think about this one, this Z2, all right? And I can imagine, I can ask what happens to the theory if I try to gauge the Z2, right? So instead of this being a global transformation of all the Wilson lines by a constant element, I make it local, make it depend on position, all right? So I try to gauge the Z2. Imagine gauging the Z2. Why would I do that? Because that will expose the Toft anomalies, right? So if I find that the partition function picks up, say, a phase after trying to gauge the Z2, that constitutes what's called a Toft anomaly. And it's a barrier to doing that, an obstruction to doing that. And the point is, even though I don't gauge the Z2, that anomaly survives into the IR, as we heard about several times this week, and places constraints about the phase of the IR theory. All right? And so we can ask, what is that constraint? And you know, can we cancel the anomaly, for example? That's something we would like to do, too, in general.
So Simon, why is it an anomaly? You're sure it's a symmetry?
I haven't shown you anything yet. I'm just saying, if it were. I'm just going to imagine gauging this Z2. So we have this global Z2 we agree on, right? It's a symmetry of this gravitational theory now, right? But I can imagine trying to gauge it on a torus, say, where there's non-contractible cycles, so the Wilson loops are non-trivial around those cycles. So because it's a one-form symmetry, if I try to gauge it, I need a two-form gauge field. Right? Just like an ordinary zero-form symmetry, you need to introduce an A mu, a one-form gauge potential. Here you'll need a two-form guide. Right? So there's some B mu nu. You know, some, if you want on the lattice, it will be a Blaquette-based gauge field that will help gauge this. And so what I can do is choose different backgrounds for that gauge field and examine how the partition function depends on those backgrounds. So I'll have to put a B mu nu, and I'll put some background gauge field on and examine, you know, the theory in the vicinity of one of those backgrounds. And I can always pick a background with a non-zero flux. By which I mean the integral of B. Remember, B, this is a Z2 symmetry, so B is valued in Z2 also. So there are only two possibilities for the flux, 0 and pi. All right. So I can imagine putting a B field on the background corresponding to gauging the original Z2 with a single flux through some portion of the lattice, or the manifold. Okay. So that's a great question. I need to move to a manifold with non-trivial cycles to get these Wilson line operators to be non-trivial. So now you can think of your torus if you want. So to keep the Z4 symmetry, I'm going to just put a 4-fermion term in. And it can be an arbitrarily weakly coupled 4-fermion term just to explicitly break the symmetry down to Z4 rather than relying on the original anomaly. So it's a little awkward, So we'll have in our back of our minds, it won't affect any of the calculation, that there's a 4-Fermi term here, which automatically breaks me to Z4. Now, even on the torus. All right, but I'm going to consider these backgrounds with non-zero flux. And there's a general statement, it's well known, and it came up yesterday, that when you have non-zero flux, it tends to fractionalize topological charges. So I'm going to give you an argument for that in a second, but this is a generic statement. So what's happening is that the original Z4 symmetry depended on the Euler number through a flux. I mean, the flux was precisely, and that Euler number was like a kind of topological term, right? It's the integral of the curvature term in two dimensions, right? So what's happening, so that's an integer to give you the Z4 symmetry. If you can provide, if you can basically generate fractional fluxes, then you will bring that down by a factor of two. So what that means is the original Z4 symmetry will be broken by gauging the Z2 center. So it's an example of a mixed Toft anomaly, mixed between a zero-form symmetry and a one-form symmetry. All right, so this is going to break the Z2, but let me give you an argument for that. Sorry, the Z4, right? So I gauge the Z2, and I'm going to end up breaking the Z4, right? So that's an example of a Toft anomaly. So let me give you a hand wave for this on the lattice, right? So on the lattice, this center symmetry, this thing we've been discussing, is just a trivial statement that I can take the gauge lengths and multiply them by -1. And things like the Wilson-Blackett don't care, but non-trivial Wilson lines do care, right? So on the lattice, these are already line elements, but you can see, and that's how the transformation acts on them. So, but now you have a problem. If I take the original Wilson-Blackett, which is necessary to get the original, this is the thing I end up getting the topological term from, right? So that's some square, goes like this. If I just flip the sign of one of those links and it's not global, this is not an invariance of this action anymore, right? Right, so if I just try to flip the sign of a single link in the Wilson-Blackett, it's just not an invariance. I can make an invariance if I couple the U1 to the B. That's the point about V, so you're gauging that local symmetry. So I can put, on the same side, I can put the B lives on Blackett's, so B is on Blackett's, it's a two-form. And so what I can do is I can arrange the Blackett so that it's going like this, right? Has the opposite orientation. That sits on top of this. This is now gauge invariant. So I have to generalize my Wilson loop on the lattice in the presence of this background field to couple it directly to this, the B, right? That's the analog of putting in a covariant derivative to gauge the symmetry. Okay. Then if I look at my original measure, right, for the fermions, we know that transformed originally like e to the I pi chi under Z4. So that was the original transformation of the measure we went through. When I stick in the explicitly in terms of chi, the Z4 acts like this, so chi is 2, and I get 2 pi, and I'm good, right? So originally, this was an invariance for chi equals 2. What happens now, as you can see, when I take the product of these Wilson Blackett's over the whole lattice, I pick up a new term, which is related to the product of the B's. Now, consider a B which is zero everywhere except a single Blackett. So in the lattice Gauss theory language, that would be called a center vortex or something like that. So I consider a B field which is zero everywhere except a single Blackett. So it's very easy to do the product over all Blackett's. I just get the single Blackett. That carries a phase e to the I pi because it's valued in the center, 2 pi over 2, right? So I can imagine a background. I have to modify the action to gauge it, put a background field in where there's a single pi flux on one Blackett, and you see what happens. This now picks up an additional, so chi is zero maybe, but let's just leave it in for now. The fermion measure now picks up an additional e to the I pi when I do one of these twisted chiral transformations. So it flips sign in general for one copy of the Kähler-Dirac field, right? So this is the anomaly I was advertising. So the partition function is no longer invariant under the Z4 once I put this B field in and then choose the B field to be one of these center vortices. By the way, you can write all of this in terms of boundary conditions in the continuum. So that's well understood how to do this. I'm trying to give you a more of a physical flavor, you know, by talking about the lattice at all.
So how does the B field couple to the fermion?
It doesn't. Remember, the fermions are singlets under the Z2. It only couples to Wilson lines. It doesn't even couple to omega. What it does, basically, it's equivalent to saying, I want to demand the theory is invariant with large gauge transformations, which take me to this other sector minus one. That's another way of saying what we're doing. So the theory is not fully invariant under large gauge transformations, ones that take me to this sector, I think. But yeah.
Should I view this as a mixed anomaly or just
a... It's a mixed anomaly, right. So it's a Z4, Z2 mixed anomaly. So I gauge the Z2, this one-form symmetry, it breaks the zero-form Z4.
Then can you please repeat the argument?
Sorry?
Can you just repeat the argument?
Sorry?
Can you please just repeat what you just said, the entire argument?
Repeat what I just said. So the presence of this phase down here is an example of a mixed anomaly, right? Maybe, I started with two good symmetries, a Z4 and a Z2.
Maybe my question is, you said this symmetry is not even experienced by the fermion. Then why are we talking about the fermions here?
Oh, but the fermions still transform into the Z4.
Uh-huh.
Right? I mean, it's a transformation on the fermion. The Z4 is the transformation on the fermions. The Z2 is only a transformation on the Wilson lines.
Okay.
But nevertheless, when you gauge one, you break the other, because to make the theory fully gauge invariant, I have to modify the term which arises from the fermion integration, which is this U12, by coupling it to B. Mm. And that B carries that flux along with it. It's a trivial modification of the old calculation, basically. And so you just pick up a minus sign, that's all. So it breaks the Z4 to a Z2. All right? So this is where the four Fermi term really plays a role. Because I'm putting a four Fermi term in, I'm freezing the Z4. Right? So if I add two copies of the fermions, I don't get Z8 or something like that. I just keep it Z4. Right? That means if I have two copies of this system, I get twice the coefficient in both of these. So I can convert this to a 2i pi for two copies of the Kähler Dirac field. So the claim is I can cancel this mixed anomaly if I have two copies of the Kähler Dirac field.
Mm-hmm. So for the original U1 gamma symmetry, what's the classification of anomaly?
So what is the
classification of the original U1 gamma symmetry?
It was originally an anomalous breaking of U1 to Z4. I'm even just enforcing that by allowing an explicit four Fermi term now.
By having how many copies can you cancel it?
Two copies. Two copies of the full Kähler Dirac field.
No, I'm just talking about the original U1 gamma symmetry.
Oh, if I just go back to that,
I
just had two copies, it would convert that to Z8, because I'd have twice the fermion. The measure would transform by another factor of two upstairs.
What's the classification of the U1 gamma anomaly?
You're probably asking me something I don't...
So
I've never fully understood in the condensed matter literature what people mean by the classification of these.
By putting how many copies together, where the anomaly disappear?
Two, here, for this one. Uh-huh. So I don't know what you call that. Let me maybe reassure you this is not super crazy, because you already know the answer here. Let me go back to flat space. So I'm claiming that I can cancel this other anomaly off. The claim is I can cancel the anomaly off with two copies of my original Kähler Dirac field in the presence of these four Fermi terms. Right? Now, let's do some counting. So in two dimensions, one Kähler Dirac field equals two Dirac fermions. Right? So if I have two copies, that would mean I had four Kähler Dirac fields in the flat space limit, which is 8 Majorana. In four dimensions, one Kähler Dirac field equals four Dirac times two copies equals 16 Majorana if I go to real rep. So what I'm getting by this constraint for my Kähler Dirac fermions in the flat space limit reproduces these known magic numbers for gravitational anomalies of Majorana fermions that you get from topological insulators. They also you can get from this Dieffried theorem and things like this. So the Kähler-Dirac thing is getting them in a different way from a different symmetry, different set of symmetries, but the Toft anomalies of the scalar rack system are reproducing what is already known from the perspective. These are the numbers of fermions which cancel off all the Toft anomalies for Weyl fermions. So this one is associated with fermion parity. It's a discrete symmetry too. This one with the spin Z4 symmetry, right? Some of you probably know this. So what's nice about this argument is it's reproducing those numbers. And of course, everything has been now in the continuum for a while, but this is precisely how we got into this game. So Shailesh had some nice simulations in like 2014 or 15, which were arguing, which involved producing a massive symmetric phase, so gapping the fermions without breaking any symmetries in a staggered lattice model. And that's not generically what you expect. What generically you expect are condensates of various forms that break symmetries. And so what it seemed like Shailesh had bumped into was a model which was able to gap those fermions without breaking symmetries. And when you calculated how many naive fermions they corresponded to from the staggered counting, you got precisely these numbers. So what this argument is I've kind of sketched for you now is an argument based on anomalies for why these are special in the context of Kayla Dirac or, if you want, staggered fermions. So it doesn't tell you anything you didn't really already know, but it tells it you in a different way, I guess. So odd dimensions, let's see now. Well, you can still put the explicit four Fermi term in. So you can still force a Z4, even without the anomaly. So I'm, you know, that's almost a separate story. The Z2 is still there. It's just the same. So I think it's exactly the same. So I think you need two copies. Hang on. Let's see. Yes, two copies. But of course, in three dimensions, two copies would be 16 Majorana still. So it does work, actually. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, strictly it should be, right? And I'm thinking of putting it on a fixed background. If I imagine I'm doing quantum gravity, then it certainly is dynamical. But I think I can imagine doing this kind of trick, even if this is a static field, can't I? I think it's called a different name, as far as I can tell. I talked to Eric Poppitz about this, and he said, oh, I've written a paper about this, and it's called BCF anomalies or something. It's the same arguments, but yeah. There's some subtlety. It's not a dynamical field unless you want it to be. I mean, you can always think I'm letting it fluctuate a little bit. You know. Yeah. Okay. What? No, we must be out of time now. Yeah. So let me. Is there anything else to summarize here? So the take home from all of this at the moment is that these Kayla Dirac fermions are very nice from the perspective of lattice physics because they are very close to the continuum. And some of the interesting infrared phases you see in these theories seem to be consistent with the results of these new types of Toft anomalies specific to Kayla Dirac fermions. And that because the anomaly structure, well, maybe not this last part, I don't know, but at least the first part of the anomaly structure survives exactly on the lattice with no corrections, the results are just as valid for the lattice theories as they are in the continuum. And so I'll stop there. That was something else I could tell you about, but I won't, because I think we're out of time.
Thank you for two nice talk.
Thank you. I was wondering, so in all dimension, can the Z21 form symmetry itself has anomaly?
So this second argument I gave you about this mixed anomaly really doesn't rely strongly on the first argument. They're almost separate statements, right? Because in the end, to make sure it does what I need it to do, I effectively add a small explicit four Fermi term to the action anyway. So my symmetry is always Z4 whatever, even in three dimensions. That's what we were just saying. So all I really need is an explicit discrete chiral symmetry on the fermions, quasi-chiral symmetry on the fermions, and then the recognition that there's this one form Z2 as well. Mm-hmm. And then gauging the one form Z2 will still break the Z4.
Probably I misunderstood your argument. But I think that Z2 symmetry is related to something like a gravitational.
Yes, it still has a gravitational flavor, but it's coming from the spin connection.
For example, if you, in our dimension, you put in some gravitational transimons term, then after you gauge that Z2 one-form symmetry, probably you will, the Z2 itself will have an anomaly and you cannot gauge it.
Maybe. Yeah, I haven't thought about, you can write down a gravitational transimons term in odd dimensions, that's certainly true. And that, I don't know how it couples exactly to this B, so I'm not sure.
Oh, sorry. So I want to make sure, is that Z2 something like a gravitational?
It is. Because it's basically saying the holonomy of the spin connection can flip sign.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Right.
Yeah. At the end, you mentioned this agreement between your analysis and the previous analysis of 8 and 16.
Yeah.
Why should I expect such an agreement?
It's subtle, right? Because this is only, I can only decompose it into spinners when I go back to flat space, right? Otherwise, I really can't decompose it into spinners.
They're also different symmetries.
Exactly. So one or two symmetries here are mocking up a whole bunch of different discrete symmetries in the ordinary calculation, I think.
Furthermore, I think there's a mismatch of dimensions by one. Right? When we say the 8, we usually mean the...
I'm all Euclidean space here, so 4 for me means 3 plus 1 if you want, but I'm ignoring the signature. Yeah?
Yeah, it's probably related. This is matching of the magic number. Is it deep down because the Kähler fermion doesn't require it? Because many of those are anomalies.
Yeah. You might have expected a different result, actually. Right. Except that in the end, I guess I'm doing the argument based on a torus, which admits a spin structure either way. You can,
But still there, this would mean that your result would not depend on the torus.
Yeah, it would be a stronger result, I guess. And I don't need to say anything about non-orientable either, which is part of those arguments too, right, as I understand it. This is implicitly orientable, as far as I'm concerned.
Can you put it on unorientable at all?
You can. I don't think you can. I'm not sure. Yeah, I don't think you can, actually. At least I don't know how to do it. I know the prescription for discretizing the Kähler-Dirac onto an orientable simplex. I assume it doesn't work if you go to a non-orientable simplex. But maybe that's the kind of argument you need to make if you want to leave omega out of it and just work directly on the simplex. It might be if you admit non-orientable simplex triangulations, maybe that's the clue to how you would see the same structure emerge there. So I'm just talking now, thinking about it, might be related, actually. But I don't know how to do it offhand, so.
I have two questions. The first question is that you are using, here you say U1 is broken to Z4 because you think that smallest magnitude of Euler number times 2.
Well, if you want to include that in your ensemble, if you want things to work on the sphere.
Can you put it on like CP2, which has Euler
number? Yes, you don't need a spin structure.
Do I need spin structure? Because I thought that...
No, you don't. You do not. Yeah,
yeah, but can I put it on CP2?
I haven't done so, but I think so.
Yeah, if I can put it on CP2, CP2 has Euler number 1.
Okay.
And
maybe that's another way of getting the same thing. You put it on CP2, that's true, and then you won't even need this mixed anomaly. You automatically get... No, that wouldn't work. Okay, no. Let me not think too quickly.
Yeah,
but you're right. It does depend on the Euler number. So if you want to admit different manifolds in, then you may get different constraints. So I'm using the most natural one that I'm aware of, which is the completion of flat space into a sphere, right? But if you want to argue with me about what it should use, then I agree. The result depends on chi, so it is.
And another question is that you said that the magic number is d equals to 2 and d equals to 4, and the next natural candidate is d equals to 6, which has 8 Dirac fermions, and then you have
32
Majanov.
Right. So the Kayla-Dirac is counting most of those numbers for you. It's the internal number of degrees of freedom inside the Kayla-Dirac field that's responsible for the counting.
But if I remember correctly, omega pin plus 6 is Z2, not Z32.
I thought it was 32 Majorana in D=6, but I'm not an expert.
Okay, sure.
I was just going to ask you later, but could you say something about what you were talking about with random triangulations? Is that related directly to this, or is this something?
Only in as much as the original anomaly I talked about only depends on chi, and not, you know, I can use any random triangulation for that.
Okay.
And in fact, I have to use, in general, a random triangulation to triangulate some manifold other than flat space or the torus.
Okay, that's fine.
Yeah, that's all.
Okay, maybe we'll stop here because we have to start the next session in 10 minutes or less.
Oh.